Priya and I drove north from Westport County, Mayo, in Eastern Ireland, to visit an old friend, Siobhan Garrigan. Turning off the main road, we wind through what felt to us impossibly green fields, turned into a checkerboard by neat stone walls. We come to a fork, the right clearly a driveway to a house, and the other, tucking around a shed, seemed little more than a path, a two-wheel track along a tidal inlet. We take the path on the left, knowing our destination is yet further west. We glance quickly at each other, sure we are now not only late, but lost. But just as we think we should turn around, we come around a hedge and see our host walking down her driveway toward the path. We drive up with relief, and rolling down my window, Siobhan says in her lilting Irish accent, which I cannot imitate, "I had a feeling the car would be coming along just now. You are very welcome here." We park and follow her into the kitchen, where we and her friend Sam settle into chairs around her sturdy wooden table. Over steaming bowls of curry, cauliflower soup, hearty bread, and various cheeses, we share stories of these many years since we were last together, interspersed with her getting to know Pierrette and me, Sam. Learning Sam's family was from the area, I asked her what a plaque I'd seen at church that morning referencing a Robert Vesey Stoney of Roster Castle. Siobhan quipped that although he could not know about the plaque as he'd fully given up on church, he'll surely know about the man in the castle. Sam's family, it turns out, were among the Victorian-era colonists who came from England to settle land stolen from the Irish. And Roster Castle was, in fact, one of his family's homes. It was with some clear discomfort that he acknowledged this was one of their homes. In its day, the castle included thousands of acres of land, mostly cultivated by landless Irish farmers. Landless Irish farmers like Siobhan's family, who, although from nearby Connemara, lived in quite similar circumstances. Again, a quip from Siobhan, this time with a wink, "We sum up the whole of Irish history, the two of us, the colonizer and the colonized." After a slice of fig cake and a cup of tea, our hearts and stomachs full, we head back down the road to Westport in the rain. I'll say more about this meal with Siobhan and Sam shortly. But first, turning to this scripture from Luke's gospel on the road to Emmaus. I first want to notice that they are not at home or on familiar ground. They're on the way, on a journey. It is the fact that before Jesus' followers were called Christians, they were called the people of the way. And it may come as some comfort to us that they didn't notice the significance of what was happening on the way, at least not initially. And that's the second thing I want to notice. The significance of their encounter only revealed itself slowly. No voice from heaven, no lightning bolt, no utter certainty. After the meal and their moment of recognition, they could admit they felt something earlier, that their hearts were burning within us as Jesus was walking with them, unpacking the scriptures. Lastly, and perhaps most crucially, I want to notice the Eucharistic character of the moment when they realized this was no ordinary stranger on the road and no ordinary meal. He took the bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Cleopas and the other disciple were not part of the 12, so they would not have been with Jesus when he shared the so-called Last Supper a few days earlier. They recognized him in these actions not because of that supposedly unique meal the church subsequently placed so much emphasis on. Instead, they noticed it because Jesus did this again and again and again at meals, both with crowds, like when he fed the 5,000 on a hilltop, and in moments of intimacy, when, during a meal, an unnamed woman brings an alabaster jar of ointment to anoint his feet. Again and again, people unexpectedly found themselves at these meals, and in the blessing and breaking and giving of bread, people found themselves to be in the presence of the holy. The lunch with Siobhan has stuck with me in part because it too was holy. She and I met in one of those places where the idea of St. Lydia's began. I wondered what I would cry. Marquand Chapel at Yale Divinity School. Siobhan, Emily Scott, and I shared in planning and leading worship in the chapel. I was captivated by Siobhan's gracious presence, always beginning the service saying, as she had all these years later as we drove up to her home, "You are very welcome here." For her, this phrase was not just intended to reduce the sense that there are insiders and outsiders, a we who might welcome a you, although it surely is that. Her whole career as a theologian has been focused on the theology and practice of peacemaking, with a special justice-driven regard for those most vulnerable, most impacted by various oppressions. Her greeting surely also is about making the outsider, the other who might not assume they have a place, know that they are indeed welcome. That part of Siobhan is deeply embedded at St. Lydia's in its practices and the way dinner church is designed, not with the privileged insider in mind, but with the newcomer who has risked crossing the threshold. Especially on Pride Weekend, we can acknowledge the depth of that risk for many queer folks who have experienced spiritual violence in previous churches. If I've done anything at all worth noticing in my years as pastor at St. Lydia's, I hope I've tried to stay steady to this vision of Jesus' radical welcome at the table. A vision Siobhan and Emily and every one of you actually have upheld and will uphold for many years to come. This tattoo of the St. Lydia's icon, four chairs pulled up to a table, will be a sacramental reminder to carry this community and its radical welcome with me wherever I go and whatever I do. People come through the door at St. Lydia's hungry for many things. Sometimes they don't even know what they're hungry for yet. Perhaps the deepest hunger we have is knowing the world is wrong when it tells us we're not enough, that we're not beautiful enough, not smart enough, not rich enough, not faithful or certain enough, not acceptable or successful in some way, not wanted. We all hunger to know these all are in the end wrong. Those accusations are all death dealing. They're intended to hurt us, to beat us down. Yet at the heart of the story from Luke is the news of new life in the face of death. All the ways the world seeks to bring despair and death fail here in the presence of the risen Christ. Here we know a deeper, more truthful story. We know that we are enough, that you are enough, more than enough, actually, because we sit at the table with Jesus as the host, all of us receiving holy food for holy people. Here and at many other holy meals in our daily lives, again and again, it is our eyes that are opened, and we recognize ourselves as God sees us, as holy and beloved. We share the sermon at St. Lydia's, and we'll hold a brief silence. And when I ring the bell, you're invited to share your stories or experiences sparked by this powerful scripture text and or by my reflections on it. And we begin in silence.